any questions or anything that's coming up for anybody this evening that you'd like to vocalize?
Is that song I'm Alive?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, David Zeller, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it settles, and then it comes up again,
mm-hmm.
and it settles.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of a current,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah.
But it's impossible to block out the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that thoughts kept surfacing. Rising and descending.
Yeah.
Stuff from the day.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Sarah Leah.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
What do I think of?
Yeah, things going on in Chochmah.
Things going
yeah.
on, exactly.
And the crucial thing to, I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
I just felt yeah. that I had to laugh at myself.
Mm. Mm.
That was the way to quiet it down a little bit.
Mm. Mm.
Think of it as a joke.
Mm. Yeah. A big part of the depth to which we can open is dependent on that one crucial moment when something arises. And it could be coming up because it's quiet, and so there's space for it to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And it could also be coming up because it's not quiet,
mm-hmm.
and because some sound brings up an irritation. And we can see this process more slowly and more deliberately when we're sitting and meditating. But it's essentially the same process that confronts us, or the same opportunity that confronts us all day long. The question being, are we going to choose in that moment our will over God's will? Or are we going to choose to surrender to God's will? And when I say God's will, of course, that's kind of a very loaded phrase, right? But those who have been coming for a while know that I don't mean God's will as in something that's written down in a book for you to do, right? But God's will rather as the whole of your experience as it's actually happening. God's will, God, meaning as it asserts in the Shema that we chanted, Adonai Echad, meaning that it's not some oneness that's separate from other stuff, but it's the oneness that includes all stuff. And that it's in fact our resistance to what is coming up moment by moment that creates the perception of separation, that creates the perception of not oneness, of inner conflict. So, for most of us, we can understand what it means to some degree, both intellectually and in our experience, what it means to surrender. And most of us have some experience of that to some degree, what it really means to not be generating resistance inside. Because it's really a stopping of something. It's not an adding of something. Well, it's both in a way. What it's the adding of, it's the adding of the awareness that you have that choice, the adding of the watching of oneself, the adding of being a presence to what is happening inside in terms of the contraction, in terms of a contraction of contraction of resistance to whatever it is that's emerging in the moment, whether it's a thought of something or whether it's something that's actually happening in the present. Whatever it is, it's the same exact contraction, and that's the crucial thing. So when we get down to the root and we're not doing things piecemeal, meaning we're not working on this issue and this issue and this issue, but we're working on the thing that has the issues in the first place, right? And the key is to feel what that basic contraction is, that basic feeling of resistance. Because that resistance is you. That resistance is actually me. It's the I. That's what the resistance is. And so in feeling it and realizing it at its root like that, and making the choice to let it be, then that contraction begins to unravel itself and allows for a new layer or a new level of depth to open up. And by depth, I just mean the actual experience of inner depth. The experience of relief, of surrender, of freedom. All day long, if you pay attention. It's just one spiritual practice after another. That's all it really is in the end. And so, the language that we use is very embedded in our separate consciousness or egoic consciousness, just the way we talk. It actually takes a real effort to come up with a language that doesn't imply the reality that our ego creates. You know, one example of this is when we say that things are hard or difficult. What does that actually mean when we say that something is difficult? It's like if you take a stress test. Did anyone ever take a stress test?
For the heart.
Yeah, have you done the stress test? And they give you some means of exerting yourself, right? Is it a machine or something, or?
Yeah, it's a meter.
Right. Right. So, when you're doing that, you're exerting yourself, and you're supposed to exert yourself up to a certain degree, right, to get the heart up to a certain level. And the aim is simply to have a certain amount of exertion. Now, you could exert yourself in the same exact way, lifting a piece of furniture and trying to get it around a corner, and describe that as being difficult, and describe the stress test as just something you were doing. There's nothing particularly difficult about it. You're just exerting. It just takes a lot of energy. Because the difficulty, the idea of difficulty, is just a psychological, it's just a psychological reality. It means that we have this aim that we're aiming at. We're trying to get this furniture from here to there. And we're experiencing this frustration because of the angles of the thing, or trying to get it up the stairs or whatever. And so we call it difficult. But in reality, it's just exertion and calculation. You know, it's just moment by moment action. It's only because part of us is envisioning this thing that we're trying to get to. And as opposed to taking a glass of water up the stairs, which is doesn't take very much strenuousness or calculation, we call that easy. And the other thing is difficult. But when we learn how to drop that knot of contraction that resists, that doesn't want it, that doesn't want to have to exert, or doesn't want to have to deal with the railing or the angle, that doesn't want to have to deal with the situations that are coming up in our life moment to moment, that wants it to be other than actually how it really is, once that's released, then there's actually no difficulty in life moment to moment. And sometimes some traditions call that effortlessness. You know, they say that everything becomes effortless.
Are you saying that if you don't try to achieve anything, then everything is easy? Is that what I hear you saying?
It's a subtle thing. It's not so much about not trying. It depends on what you mean by trying. Right? It's all about what we mean by the word trying, by what we mean by the word difficult, and by what we mean by the word effort, and words like that.
So it's not an action itself. But
right. Exactly. Exactly. Because we have no choice if we're going to survive. We have no choice but to accomplish things. Right? It's not about whether we're going to accomplish things or just, forget about it. I'm not going to accomplish things. We can't not accomplish things. So, right, so it's all about how we're relating to that which we're trying to accomplish. Another way of saying it is becoming aware of how we are grasping onto or identifying with our inner tools, our inner mechanisms for accomplishing. Are we our exertion? Are we the resistance to exertion? Are we the feeling that comes up that wants things to be different than they are? Or can we accept that feeling that comes up as part of what is? And this is why, as this awakening process begins to open in depth and really open itself to us, why it's often described in this spiritually language of oneness, because the difference between what is arising inside and what's happening outside breaks down. Doesn't mean that you can't tell the difference, that it's in your body or that it's out here. Of course you can tell the difference, but there's no difference in terms of one of them being more me than the other. They're both just phenomena in our field of awareness. The awareness being acceptance, being an accepting presence. which is ultimately what you are when you stop defining yourself as being this, as being in here. Not a philosophical thing, it's a feeling thing. And so the next moment that presents itself, there's something to either do or not do. We're either going to get up and begin something or stay sitting down. But it's because the path is open to us, not because we are trying. It's actually effortless. You know, your brain makes a signal, your legs move, you get up, it's effortless. If you have something wrong with your back, maybe it takes a little bit of a different kind of motion, but it's still effortless. Maybe you try to get up and you fall down, but it's still effortless. Because there's no identification with the aim of what you're doing. There's no tension or resistance to what you're experiencing, to what's coming up in your experience. And then that will of God, which is simply everything that's happening all around us all the time, becomes conscious in us. We become conscious of it. And then the way that we interact with the beings that we interact with doesn't feed the game of suffering. Doesn't feed the dynamics between us that are creating some drama that we want to get out of. It just allows. It's nurturing. It doesn't want anything. It doesn't try to get something. And giving isn't a big deal. It's not romantic compassion. It's just part of what it means to interact. We give.
It's quite a difficult word to leave.
No, I'm so happy you used the word difficult. Because, you know, it's true, it's difficult. Until we realize the absurdity of that, you know? Because as we think about it, we create a picture, you know? What it would be like if I was doing that? What would life actually look like?
If I was doing what?
Living in a way that was free, that was awake. But actually, we don't need to do that. We don't need to envision it at all. And it's sort of the opposite. What's necessary is not to envision it, to preconceive it, so that it becomes an aim that we're going after. What's necessary is simply to be with what is and be where we are, which naturally happens when you accept. Because there's nothing else except this. We don't have to try to be present. They're just, the present is the main thing. Once we give up to other stuff. Which is to say, once we give up resisting the present. But to not resist the present, you have to be aware that everything that's happening is actually part of the present, and it isn't you. have to be aware that this emotion coming up is simply part of the present, simply part of what's happening. This opinion arising in my brain that's judging is simply a thought that's arising in my brain that I can accept. And I accept the thought arising in my brain, I accept the thing out there that's being judged, I accept the whole thing. You, each person, is much bigger than what we identify with, than the side that we tend to take over and over again. And that's what Pesach is all about. It's about liberation.
Together.
Right.
We think of it conventionally as the opposed. Giving up, surrendering is the opposite of liberation.
Right.
In conventional terms,
right. And the story of Pesach lends itself to that conventional understanding until we look at the symbolism of the particulars of the story. You know, so one of the more outstanding and obvious features of the story that hints at the inner reality of what's going on is this whole business about needing to leave Egypt right away, as soon as it's time. Right? Because the opportunity for liberation happens in the moment that something arises that we identify with. It can't happen later or before that. It's only in the moment when we become trapped that we have the opportunity to not buy into that, to embrace it, and then an inner alchemy can happen. The process happens all by itself. And part of the trick of it is that it happens the way it wants to happen. So the practice of acceptance applies it to the process also. Sometimes it feels extraordinary, sometimes it doesn't feel like much, but you just keep on applying again and again the same exact attitude of acceptance toward what is, and inevitably the process will deepen, will open up, and the liberation will become more and more the reality that you live in. And the bondage become less and less of the reality that you live in. But it takes a sharp watchfulness to be really on it, moment to moment. And that's that Pesach night. That readiness, you know, with your satchels ready to go. You have to be ready to go. Because while you're walking through and nothing's really bothering you and you're feeling relatively okay because you're a psychologically healthy person, if you're not a psychologically healthy person, then you actually have a lot more opportunity. That's the ironic part. You have less of a likeliness of taking the opportunity. Because people who are psychologically unhealthy tend to, in my experience, tend to be buying in way more into that whole egoic reality.
Adjustment.
What do you mean?
what the external world or society enforces.
You're saying that's
the pathology. I imagine psychological health, sociological health, to be, or that's what I've been told or taught.
Being able to function within the right. Right. Well, psychological unhealth, there's probably lots of different kinds, but the kind that I encounter most often in my life, people around me, psychological unhealth basically consists of exaggerated neuroses, of exaggerated fears, of exaggerated stories, and so there's more tension in general, more drama and more tension. And so ironically, there's more of an opportunity for awakening there, because there's so much stuff that can actually, there's so much catalyst there, that if it's actually accepted and if a person can choose not to buy into it, then the whole structure can collapse. Whereas when we're more psychologically healthy, we have to be more watchful, because our resistance, that process, that ego as a verb. Often we talk about ego as if it's a thing, but it's, I think, more accurately understood as a thing that we do when we clench, you know. And when that happens, there's an opportunity for transformation. The other piece of the Passover story that is related to what we were just talking about with psychological pain is that the story begins with the Israelites crying out that, you know, God help us, God save us. And the way the story goes, you know, the Israelites came down to Egypt, and there was a nice Pharaoh at first, right? Right? The Pharaoh seems nice.
Like Joseph.
Yeah. Like Joseph. Joseph brought his brethren down. And this is exactly what this ego-making process is within ourselves. It's actually, it doesn't just seem nice, it is beneficial. It's something that we need to develop in our childhood. It's a healthy, normal thing to develop a sense of self. And it's necessary for us to function, just as it was necessary for the Israelites to survive, to come into Egypt during the famine, because that's where the stored up grain was for them. And then the slavery didn't happen all at once. It happened gradually, bit by bit, so people didn't quite notice what was happening. And this is psychologically exactly what happens. What we're doing internally in our building up of ego is something that we're not really aware of as we do it. And there's often not the motive to transcend it until we've had enough of the pain of it. It's not true for everyone. I mean, some people can be really spiritually passionate and just really driven and into it. But for many, many people, we turn to it because other stuff, we realize it's not working, it's not satisfying, and you start to wake up to the fact that the main pain of your life, the main pain of your existence is not what's being done to you. It's what you're doing in yourself, or something like that, some intuition of that, that'll often lead us to wanting to pursue this kind of path.
The story starts with a selling of Joseph, selling of one for ourselves into slavery.
Say again, I'm sorry.
What I'm saying is the story to me seemed to be starting when the brothers of Joseph sold him.
Right.
Into slavery, which is allegorical for selling part of us.
Yeah.
To some sort of story.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And then it's just recurrence yet again in a different cycle.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, there's a process of a freedom that's already the fact of what is. It's already there. It's not something we have to work for or achieve, but we sacrifice it. We give it up. For what? All those different ways to answer that, you know. Different traditions have different myths to put different spins on it, you know. Ultimately, what I hear most of the Kabbalists saying is that we do it because it's because the fact of doing it is what builds up the consciousness of being able to appreciate and really know what the freedom is.
So we have to lose it before we can appreciate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you start the separation. Your consciousness starts.
So there, if you want to use that as slavery of being, I mean, whatever thing you want to say, but basically, if you don't have that separation, then you can't, then the consciousness, you're not aware of this. And I guess it's.
Right. Right. There's no developed me to receive it, to receive the blessing, as the Kabbalists would say, that the purpose of the universe is to be able to receive blessing.
That's that you're conscious of this blessing.
Right, exactly.
Everybody's receiving this blessing. I mean, children have this, it's a blessing.
Right.
Whether you're
aware of it. And the implication of that myth, of that Kabbalistic mythological idea that the universe has to be created to receive blessing, is that God doesn't know that it's blessed. There's no consciousness of blessing. Otherwise, why would God have to create this universe so that beings could evolve within it in order to be conscious of blessing? It wasn't enough for God just to be God. It wasn't enough for whatever that, you know, undifferentiated reality to just be itself. It's not enough. There's no realization of it. There's no consciousness of it. Kabbalists don't say that. That's just me taking it a step further. Because they wouldn't, theologically, it would be difficult for them to say something like that God didn't know something, you know. But it's in the subtext, you know. Those, that heretical substrat.
It's very human, but not the human.
What's that?
The strange idea to me that it's not enough for God's sake.
Right.
It's very anthropological. Anthropomorphous?
Yes,
anthropomorphous.
Right.
The people who never have enough.
Right.
Everybody else seems to be.
Well, it, ironic, well, what it is that it is enough, and it's only when you think there isn't enough that you can then consciously go back into the state of it being enough and be able to appreciate it. Only by that beginning of everything where the amoeba has to select this piece of schmutz to eat and not that piece of schmutz to eat, because that's not helpful and this is helpful. And there's that beginning of differentiation from the very first, you know, the first pieces of life on the planet. That's where sensing comes from. You know, that's where the ability to sense comes from, this and not that. And from that all the way up grows awareness, and then somehow this magic thing happens as a byproduct, self-awareness, and then ego in human beings, sense of self as something different, when before that it was just a flow of forces interacting, sensing, perpetuating. And then the ultimate choice, spiritually speaking, to be able to surrender that, to let go of that, and enter back into that stream of the everything.
Do you remember that movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Yeah.
In the end, with all the flowing colors and the end of the narrative, but then maybe over a half an hour of just colors and blobs and worlds. I thought it was just so daring for a movie maker to do that. But
right.
I think about that.
Is that Kubrick?
As a return, because the last scene was of the baby. You know,
Right. So the movie is kind of, perhaps the intention was to invite you into that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what I remember more is the Mel Brooks spoof on that. I won't explain it if any. Yeah, exactly.
Mel Brooks is a holy
man. Yeah, right. Definitely. Anyway, so we have some new folks, so why don't we just go around the room for a minute and say our names, and if you want to say something else, especially you new folks, about what brought you here, and, you know, whatever you'd like to share.
I'm Jamie, and I'm Jewish, and I've been studying a lot of Buddhism for the past, I don't know, 6 years, whatever, and really not feeling very connected to Judaism, and just trying to figure out how to combine the two, or just find my own way into Judaism. I did a little bit of searching, and then kind of gave up for a little while, and then I just recently did a Jewish meditation retreat, and that kind of, got me going, and really kind of excited to figure out, my way into Judaism, and see what feels good to me. So.
Can I ask you when you did your retreat?
I did my retreat, it was in Mill Valley, it was with Jeff Roth, who's a rabbi. It's called the Awakened Heart Project, and it's Jewish Renewal, and Sylvia Borstein and Norman Fisher.
Really?
Yeah, it was a really
Do you know if they have another one?
Yeah, they have lots of them.
Huh? Well, with those three people, I don't know about that. I think they might do it next year. But Sylvia Borstein teaches, and Norman Fisher teaches, and they all teach, and Jeff teaches separately, but I don't know. It was really
but weird. Google Awakened Heart Project, and yeah, you should be able to...
Awakened Heart Project?
Yeah.
You get on their mailing list. I'm somehow on their mailing list, and I don't even know why.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a great...
Yeah, it looks amazing.
Do you know Jeff?
I don't, actually. I know Sylvia and Norman a little bit, but yeah.
I am Simone, and actually I have a similar experience where I started doing some Buddhism, and some of it I liked, and then when they went into this ceremony of Buddha, I got really repelled.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked, you know, when you go to, I went to Gringotts, lectures and which people say, well, they stole it from Judaism anyway. You know, the principles of compassion and kindness and love. Anyway, and I did.
We own it.
Yeah, okay. So people say, I don't know, you know, I'm certainly not knowledgeable, but. And I ran into Norm Fisher and I really liked him. And you know, so after this experience of going to Gringotts, and I happened to see a, what do they call it? When people become a monk, they have a ceremony. I forget what it's called. Anyway, they go on and on felt really horrible that day. Anyway, so I Googled Jewish spirituality, and what came up was Chokhmat. You know, it was like, it must be something Jewish that can connect, like, you know, the two. And then I found this place, and I was like, oh, that is the one that I've been looking for.
Nice.
So I'm pretty excited to, you know, actually found this place.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's a good feeling.
Nice. It's nice to hear that kind of story, because that's really was a huge part of the motivation for the creation of this place.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so many Jewish people that have sought this kind of direct path of spirituality through meditation often takes a Buddhist route, because that's just where we are historically. Buddhism has been flourishing in this part of the world, and introducing that, even though there are many traditions that have that, but Buddhism has been the main one. And so many Jews, you know, and so there was the intention to make this side of Judaism available. But the truth is that opening up this side of Judaism in a way that's really emphasizing this, that's not kind of demanding all of the external halakhic demands, you know, all the rules, that's not coming and asserting, hey, you got to do all this stuff, you know, the ideology of that is somewhat unique. It's a new thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's heartening to know that it's serving, so, yeah.
I'm Jordan. I came to this place, I don't know, 6 years ago. A dear friend of mine, both of his parents died within a short period of time. He wanted to say Kaddish for his parents. He was afraid to come here by himself.
Mm.
He'd been out of Judaism for a long time.
Mm.
So he said, would you please come with me on Friday night so I could say Kaddish, so I won't feel so scared.
Oh, wow.
And so I did. And I just felt mad.
I never heard that story. Hi. Hi.
And that's how I found it.
Yeah. Thank you.
My name's Gary. I used to go to the place on 8th Street. That was, I don't know how many years, probably 10.
Mm-hmm.
But I found the place, strangely enough, reading the book, I think, one of the two books of, remember his name now, one is called Julian Lotus, Kamenets, and another one is Stalking a Bunch.
Right.
He took some class with Jonathan, former man, who's got an interesting take on stealing anything from Judaism.
Mm.
He said something like, Judaism was looking for Jewish answers to the universal questions.
Mm.
Anything which is unique, if the questions are unique to Judaism, then it becomes irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
In the larger scheme of things.
Mm.
And I went to his classes in LA when he had it. And then, since I come in and going all the time, you know, disappearing for a year or two, and then reappearing again.
Yeah. Off sailing, seven seas.
Traveling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm just there.
Yeah. Nice to have you back.
I'm Jane, and I started meditating this year about the next year. I got involved actually because I had some friends who were meditating. So I said that I'm sort of on the meditation, mostly secular. Jewish upbringing, probably
Yeah, welcome.
My name is Paulina, and I looked at you once earlier, but I'm not sure if I knew you, so sorry that it took me a while. And I came in late. Hi, nice to see you. So I've been coming to Hopewatt for a while and have been really interested in the meditation programs here and just haven't really taken the time to connect. So I'm trying harder now to connect because I feel like it's a great thing that this community offers. And I was involved with meditation before, with Buddhism, and then got involved, then through Buddhism got more involved with Judaism. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm kind of back saying, like, I really want both. And so mm-hmm. I'm hoping that this will be a community where I can work on both
mm-hmm.
together.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess another reason that's bringing me here right now is both my parents are old and ill. And I feel like it's a challenge as far as just navigating your way through mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is really helpful in that context too.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
Yes. Might as well.
Since you're similarly, I sat down because I'm going to meet with Brian later, and it was my intention to try to come earlier and meditate with you all, but I got distracted by my partner and I going out on a hike. So
it's nice too.
It was a good thing for us to do.
Yeah. All right, thank you all for coming. And hope to see you again. We do this every Monday night. And a little bit more introductory on the fourth Monday of the month.
I have to ask about this Sunday, 7 to 9 on the bulletin.
Right.
Says you were
right.
Doing a class. Could you just...
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for reminding me. So it's a class on Pesach symbolism. Symbols of the Seder, particularly as seen as a map of awakening. So the same stuff that we're talking about here, but how each of the symbols relates to aspects of that process, and also how also connected to the narrative of creation, Bereshit, as well.
Is it one session?
Yeah, it's just from... we'll scrape the surface. No, it's a little more than 3 hours. 6-7, yeah.
6 to 9?
No.
Which it's
7 to 9. 2 hours. 2 hours. Whatever. Yeah, 7 to 9, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Are you doing services Friday? Is there services Friday?
What is this Friday? This is the second Friday, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the second Friday. Yeah, that's So this weekend is Friday night is the family service that Sarah does, Sarah Shulman.
Oh, okay.
So it's more a little more for kids.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I believe Saturday morning I think there's a contemplative service. So that's like a not at all a traditional Jewish Saturday morning service. It's silence and chanting.
Yeah.
Well, silence and chanting alternating,
yeah.
You know.
Nice,
yeah.
A nice healing circle. I don't know
yeah.
if Jonah will do it, but he does a wonderful job with healing.
Mm.
He has this great healing circle. He feels
cool.
Wonderful.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so I don't know who's leading it, but
yeah.
if it's him, it's really nice.
Yeah, so it might be him. It might be Jeffrey who does Thursday night meditation. There's a few
circle,
people. Who, okay.
Very nice.
Okay.
Jeffrey's the one that does the meditation
mm-hmm.
the Thursday night one.
All right. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks.
Hi.
Thanks. Good to meet you. Thanks. That's okay.
Do you have any suggestions for Haggadah? I'm from Baltimore, so I'm going home. And lately, I've been like doing a lot of reading, and then I'll go home and like do a sermon. Try and just connect it to people. To connect people to the holiday because I think they're so wonderful. But I need to learn more myself. So Jeff Roth told me to get Healing Our Bar Joys of Our Seasons.
Oh, Seasons of Our Joy.
Yeah, and I just bought that book, so
that's
I'm going to start with that.
Yeah, that's a great book.
But then I thought, well, you know, when we're doing the Haggadah thing, like, should I get a certain Haggadah? Should I just make it up on my own? And maybe I'll come on Sunday, and maybe I'll just learn more and decide, let it unfold.
Yeah, you know, I don't have any one specific Haggadah that I would recommend. There's like millions of them.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
You can go to the store and see.
I went and I was like, whoa, this is crazy.
Yeah, and I used to always make my own Haggadah every year,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I would call it from different places and
mm-hmm.
put it all together. And then at some point, I realized, you know, the thing that's really great and magical about Pesach is not actually the Haggadah that you use.
Mm-hmm.
It's what happens between the people at the table,
mm-hmm.
the conversations that are spurred on.
Mm-hmm.
So now I use just the driest, most traditional Haggadah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's because the traditional Haggadah is a very unusual thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the different pieces to it and so on. And there's things that irritate you in it, and that's
mm-hmm.
good because
mm-hmm.
you know that's what spurs on the conversation. So I really think my little piece would just be to say that when you go and you're doing Seder with these different people, to try to find ways to facilitate, to open people up,
mm-hmm.
to facilitate that they bring themselves to the Seder and open up, not just mentally like, I think blah, 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 which also will happen a lot, you know, but that something real can happen, you know, that something honest can be said, and that's not just a lot of intellectual blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, that being said, there's also some of the Haggadahs, they emphasize different things. So some of them are very heady and cabalistic. Some of them are really funny and cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sometimes just the thing, you know. It depends on the group. Yeah. And, of course, the songs. You know, that's a big...
Yeah.
Being able to do it if people don't know the songs, you know, picking ones, you know, that they can learn, or having ones in English, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, that helps
a
little bit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
It's
sure.
Just a journey.
Yeah.
I'll read as much as I can and,
mm-hmm.
and bring whatever I can to it.
Yeah, exactly. Bring yourself to it and bring just make it real. You know?
Yeah,
honest,
that's my
make
goal.
Make it real.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. See ya.
So if you have your email address, I'll send you this music.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we should be write it down.
Oh, can we sing the live song? Or we just do the word. We don't do the word.
We could. I mean, I generally you do just negun like wordless, but
God, I love the word.
I don't
I
even
miss
remember
that song.
The words. Maybe you could you sing, maybe you could
No. Really bad. David Teller song?
Yeah, yes.
God, I love that song. Oh yeah, there's English and Hebrew.
That's good.
So
Okay, great, thank you. And if you want, when you send it, I can put you on my mailing list for things like this. If you want.
Well,
that's
not
huge.
Oh, you have? Okay.
We sang it every morning, and like, we sang a bunch of things every morning, but there were like three of my favorites, and that was like, definitely my favorite. I'm like singing to myself in the car, and I've like sang it to some of my friends.
You know, it's, if you want to hear the person who wrote it, his name is David Zeller, he died last year, and he's just, he was such a light, and I miss him so much. And he lived in Israel for the last probably 15 or so maybe longer years. Mm-hmm. We've adopted